Chapter 8. Escape from the Ice. On April 7th, at daylight, the long-desired peak of Clarence Island came into view, bearing nearly north from our camp. At first it had the appearance of a huge berg, but with the growing light we could see plainly the black lines of scree and the high precipitous cliffs of the island, which were miraged up to some extent. The dark rocks in the white snow were a pleasant sight. So long had our eyes looked on icebergs that apparently grew or dwindled according to the angles at which the shadows were cast by the sun. So often had we discovered rocky islands and brought in sight the peaks of Joinville Land, only to find them, after some change of wind or temperature, floating away as nebulous cloud or ordinary berg, that not until Worsley, Wilde, and Hurley had unanimously confirmed my observation was I satisfied that I was really looking at Clarence Island. The land was still more than 60 miles away, but it had to our eyes something of the appearance of home, since we expected to find there our first solid footing after all the long months of drifting on the unstable ice. We had adjusted ourselves to the life on the floe, but our hopes had been fixed all the time on some possible landing place. As one hope failed to materialize, our anticipations fed themselves on another. Our drifting home had no rudder to guide it, no sail to give it speed. We were dependent upon the caprice of wind and current. We went whither those irresponsible forces listed. The longing to feel solid earth under our feet filled our hearts. In the full daylight, Clarence Island ceased to look like land and had the appearance of a berg not more than 8 or 10 miles away, so deceptive are distances in the clear air of the Antarctic. The sharp white peaks of Elephant Island showed to the west of north a little later in the day. I have stopped issuing sugar now, and our meals consist of seal meat and blubber only, with 7 ounces of dried milk per day for the party, I wrote. Each man receives a pinch of salt, and the milk is boiled up to make hot drinks for all hands. The diet suits us, since we cannot get much exercise on the floe, and the blubber supplies heat. Fried slices of blubber seem to our taste to resemble crisp bacon. It is certainly no hardship to eat it, though persons living under civilized conditions probably would shudder at it. The hardship would come if we were unable to get it. I think that the palate of the human animal can adjust itself to anything. Some creatures will die before accepting a strange diet if deprived of their natural food. The yaks of the Himalayan uplands must feed from the growing grass, scanty and dry though it may be, and would starve even if allowed the best oats and corns. We still have the dark water sky of the last week with us to the southwest and west, round to the northeast. We are leaving all the bergs to the west, and there are few within our range of vision now. The swell is more marked today, and I feel sure we are at the verge of the floe ice. One strong gale followed by a calm would scatter the pack, I think, and then we could push through. I have been thinking much of our prospects. The appearance of Clarence Island after our long drift seems, somehow, to convey an ultimatum. The island is the last outpost of the south and our final chance of a landing place. Beyond it lies the broad Atlantic. Our little boats may be compelled any day now to sail unsheltered over the open sea with 1,000 leagues of ocean separating them from the land to the north and east. It seems vital that we shall land on Clarence Island or its neighbour, Elephant Island. The latter island has an attraction for us, although as far as I know nobody has ever landed there. Its name suggests the presence of the plump and succulent sea elephant. We have an increasing desire in any case to get firm ground under our feet. The floe has been a good friend to us, but it is reaching the end of its journey, and it is liable at any time now to break up and fling us into the unplumbed sea. A little later, after reviewing the whole situation in the light of our circumstances, I made up my mind that we should try to reach Deception Island. The relative positions of Clarence, Elephant, and Deception Islands can be seen on the chart. The two islands first named lay comparatively near to us and were separated by some 80 miles of water from Prince George Island, which was about 150 miles away from our camp on the berg. From this island, a chain of similar islands extends westward, terminating in Deception Island. The channels separating these desolate patches of rock and ice are from 10 to 15 miles wide. But we knew from the Admiralty sailing directions that there were stores for the use of shipwrecked mariners on Deception Island, and it was possible that the summer whalers had not yet deserted its harbour. Also, we learned from our scanty records that a small church had been erected there for the benefit of the transient whalers. The existence of this building would mean to us a supply of timber, from which, if dire necessity urged us, we could construct a reasonably seaworthy boat. We had discussed this point during our drift on the floe. Two of our boats were fairly strong, but the third, the James Caird, was light, although a little longer than the others. All of them were small for the navigation of these notoriously stormy seas, and they would be heavily loaded. So a voyage in open water would be a serious undertaking. I fear that the carpenter's fingers were already itching to convert pews into topsides and decks. In any case, the worst that could befall us when we had reached Deception Island would be a wait until the whalers returned about the middle of November. Another bit of information gathered from the records of the west side of the Weddell Sea related to Prince George Island. The Admiralty sailing directions, referring to the South Shetlands, mentioned a cave on this island. None of us had seen that cave, or could say if it was large or small, wet or dry, but as we drifted on our floe, and later, when navigating the treacherous leads and making our uneasy night camps, that cave seemed to my fancy to be a palace, which in contrast would dim the splendours of Versailles. The swell increased that night, and the movement of the ice became more pronounced. Occasionally, a neighbouring floe would hammer against the ice on which we were camped, and the lessons of these blows was plain to read. We must get solid ground under our feet quickly. When the vibration ceased after a heavy surge, my thoughts flew round to the problem ahead. If the party had not numbered more than 6 men, a solution would not have been so hard to find. But obviously, the transportation of the whole party to a place of safety, with the limited means at our disposal, was going to be a matter of extreme difficulty. There were 28 men on our floating cake of ice, which was steadily dwindling under the influence of wind, weather, charging floes, and heavy swell. I confess that I felt the burden of responsibility sit heavily on my shoulders. But, on the other hand, I was stimulated and cheered by the attitude of the men. Loneliness is the penalty of leadership, but the man who has to make the decisions is assisted greatly if he feels that there is no uncertainty in the minds of those who follow him, and that his orders will be carried out confidently and in expectation of success. The sun was shining in the blue sky on the following morning, April 8th. Clarence Island showed clearly on the horizon, and Elephant Island could also be distinguished. The single snow-clad peak of Clarence Island stood up as a beacon of safety. Though the most optimistic imagination could not make an easy path of the ice and ocean that separated us from that giant, white and austere. The pack was much looser this morning, and the long rolling swell from the northeast is more pronounced than it was yesterday. The floes rise and fall with the surge of the sea. We are evidently drifting with the surface current, for all the heavier masses of floe, bergs and hummocks are being left behind. There has been some discussion in the camp as to the advisability of making one of the bergs our home for the time being, and drifting with it to the west. The idea is not sound. I cannot be sure that the berg would drift in the right direction. If it did move west and carried us into the open water, what would be our fate when we tried to launch the boats down the steep sides of the berg in the sea swell after the surrounding floes had left us? One must reckon, too, the chance of the berg splitting or even overturning during our stay. It is not possible to gauge the condition of a big mass of ice by surface appearance. The ice may have a fault, and when the wind, current, and swell set up strains and tensions, the line of weakness may reveal itself suddenly and disastrously. No, I do not like the idea of drifting on a berg. We must stay on our floe till conditions improve, and then make another attempt to advance towards the land. At 6:30 p.m. a particularly heavy shock went through our floe. The watchman and other members of the party made an immediate inspection and found a crack right under the James Caird and between the other two boats and the main camp. Within 5 minutes the boats were over the crack and close to the tents. The trouble was not caused by a blow from another floe. We could see that the piece of ice we occupied had slewed and now presented its long axis towards the oncoming swell. The floe, therefore, was pitching in the manner of a ship, and it had cracked across when the swell lifted the centre, leaving the two ends comparatively unsupported. We were now on a triangular raft of ice, the three sides measuring roughly 90, 100 and 120 yards. Night came down dull and overcast, and before midnight the wind had freshened from the west. We could see that the pack was opening under the influence of wind, wave, and current, and I felt that the time for launching the boats was near at hand.